The voices depicted in this program are of actors and not of the actual participants involved in the trial. In the last episode of Wheel of Justice, the Cal Harris story, I left you to consider whether or not you had heard enough to convict Cal for the murder of Michelle. Now, you may be wondering at this point, how is it that I'm still only in the first trial? And believe me, after going through the 2,000 pages, I sometimes feel the same way. But the truth is that this first trial is where the story is built and where we really meet the characters for the first time. This first trial is the foundation for all of the subsequent trials. When I started poring over all the information related to this case, I may have had a preconceived idea about what happened and whether or not Cal was involved. The more involved I get, though, the more I go back and forth on whether I think Cal had motive enough to kill the mother of his children. One thing I know for sure is that the evidence against him is a tad thin. There's a lot of info about him being a bad husband, but none of that really tells me beyond a reasonable doubt, remember that's the standard, that he's a murderer. In the end, though, what really matters is how the jury felt about the evidence on June 6, 2007, after those closing arguments. Judge Smith begins his instructions to the jurors. This is what Judge Smith says. As jurors in this case, it is your duty to decide each and every question of fact and to ultimately decide the guilt or innocence of the defendant. You are the sole and exclusive judges of the facts. It is for you to say what those facts are and what they mean, and no one may presume to tell you what the facts are. And then, at 3:04 p.m., the jurors began deliberating. At around 5:45, nearly 3 hours after deliberation began, the jurors request to go home. They began again the next day on June 7th, 2007, at 8 a.m. At around 9:25 on June 7th, the jury indicates that they have reached a verdict. And here's what they said. We find the defendant guilty, the jury foreperson announces. Almost immediately, Cal reacts.
Oh, no.
Cal's reaction is not a huge surprise. He said he didn't do it, and a jury has just announced that he did. What I think is a little bit of a shock is that it took 4 hours, only 4 hours. The jury determined that Cal Harris was guilty in 4 hours. So I was lucky enough to speak with Angela Prosinski. She was a juror in this trial. She was one of the 12 people who listened to both sides of the story and sat in the courtroom with Cal Harris, and she was one of the 12 who decided that Cal Harris was guilty. Here's how our conversation went. Ms. Prosinski, what was it like to be in the courtroom?
It was stressful. I was young at the time. It was 2001, and I had my first baby at home, and I wanted to be at home. It was stressful. None of it was taken lightly by any of us. Watching him across the room was very difficult, knowing that your decision was going to impact not only his life, but the life of his children, the life of his parents, his family. It was definitely stressful. When I left the courtroom that final day, I was actually in tears and turned down several interviews, and I didn't really want to recall it anymore.
I can certainly understand that. What was your impression of Cal Harris?
I think he likes things to go his way. I think he is a very, I don't want to say arrogant because I'm not sure that I know enough facts to say that he's arrogant, but I definitely think he wants things in his control. I think he, even the way he looked at his lawyers, the way that he looked at the jurors, it was very clear he expected things to go his way. I don't believe that he had any hesitation of thinking that there's no way he was actually going to be found guilty. There's no way that this wouldn't end in his favor, regardless of what the facts were. He was assured that it was going to go his way.
And what made you sure then and makes you sure now that Cal Harris did it?
Obviously, the case is on circumstantial evidence, so it was all of the things tied together. There were so many small details that just didn't make sense for anyone who had no idea where his wife was for the first time in their entire marriage. He was... The very first thing I remember actually writing down in my notebook was the first question they asked to Barb there was, you know, what did you see when you got there? Well, Michelle's van was at the end of the driveway.
Mm-hmm.
And when she walked into the house and she said, Cal, the van is at the end of the driveway. Did you know that? He apparently said no, but then said, well, we better go get it. Didn't grab a spare set of keys, didn't ask Barb if she saw the keys in there, just happened to know that there would be keys in an abandoned van at the end of his driveway, totally out of the blue. And it was like a quarter mile driveway. It's not, you know, it's not as if it's just sitting outside the garage door. He had to be driven there to get it. That was the very first thing that said, that's just strange. It was so bizarre to me. And then there was obviously the blood in the house mm-hmm. was, you know, that was the only real substantial put your hands on evidence that there was. And it was very compelling, especially added to the other aspects that he, you know, just the day that his wife comes up missing, he doesn't supposedly know where she is or what has happened. And, you know, he never made a single phone call to her voicemail to say, where are you? Just based on his past behavior that was testified on by his family. His family testified for the prosecution because, you know, he was very controlling. He didn't want Michelle working. He didn't want her out of the house. So for her to interrupt his work day and supposedly abandon him with his four children, not pack up any of her clothes and just leave everything, for him not to have made a single phone call to say, where are you? That is extremely odd behavior for even an average husband and wife, let alone one that was going through a divorce and was trying to keep control and trying to keep the family together.
So you saw him as a very controlling person then. That's a picture you got of him?
I really did. I really did.
You mentioned the blood. How much weight did you give to the blood evidence?
Enough. I think between the actual blood that was in the house and the experts that testified in regards to the blood that was up underneath chips of paint in the garage that may have been swept as you know, there was marks like a mop mark had made something. And granted, nobody knows. Things could have happened in there. There was no DNA in those ones. But the blood evidence really was just a single scientific proof for the behavior and I'm not talking emotional behavior. Nobody knows how someone would react if that were the case, if your wife actually came up missing. Nobody's saying that he should have cried or he should not have cried, but his actions afterwards were just not even, they weren't even within the realm of normalcy for an average household, let alone one that was going through the very glaring issues that they had.
During deliberations, what were the discussions like during deliberations?
Ours actually were very short in comparison to the next two, as you know. Ours, when we first started, we kind of went in the room and it was, you know, how many people if we voted right now would say guilty? And I believe that there was all but three. And then we said, well, how many would say not guilty? And it was two. So there was one that was just kind of undecided. And we said, okay, well, then let's negotiate, you know, let's talk back and mm-hmm. forth and see who thinks that, you know. And one of the jurors was actually just bizarre, just came up with some random hypothesis, like what if her brother did it or something. And we all just kind of looked at him like, I'm not really sure that's relevant, you know. But really, that was it. We had gone back into the courtroom also and asked the judge for reasonable doubt, a definition of reasonable doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And really, it came down to that there was no other reasonable explanation for all of the pieces that clearly fit together that only pointed in one direction. There was no reasonable explanation why anyone else would have done this. There was no reasonable explanation for someone else having the means to do so. There was no reasonable explanation for anyone else. It was just... any reasonable person could not have come up with any other conclusion. I really, truly believed that day. And then I got really nervous when they said that there was another trial because there was a witness, because I was afraid. I thought, oh my gosh, what if we really got this wrong? Like, what if we really missed something? Not because it was in evidence and we didn't have it, but we just didn't have it. And then when the whole trial went through a second time and another 12 people found him guilty, I was like, oh, thank God, you know, because it was stressful and it was very, you know, regardless of the fact of whether I think he's a, you know, cold-hearted murderer who's going out to plot his next murder, I don't think that's the case. But it doesn't change the fact that he should still pay for what he did do. But if we wrongly accused and found him, you know, guilty in error, I would have felt terrible.
But you didn't feel that after the second trial. Now, what do you think? How do you feel about the fact that there have now been three trials?
Oh, it is very, very stressful. I mean, like I said, it was a long time ago, and you would think that I wouldn't still be as adamant as I am about it, but I really, truly am. I actually, during the second trial, I almost took time off from work to go and sit because I wanted to make sure that I really didn't get it that wrong. I thought, you've got to be kidding me. How could I have gotten it that? Because I was one of the jurors who, with the conviction, I was certain that he's guilty. I still believe that he's guilty. I have no question. I have no doubt.
We've been hearing that he's going to be tried again. Do you think that's the right thing to do?
I think that as long as her family still has unanswered, honestly, I don't know, because I think even if he's found guilty, I believe that he will never, ever disclose what they really want to know. They want to know what happened to her, where is she, what did you do? And I believe that he is controlling enough that will be, he will never, ever, he'll never give them that satisfaction, that peace that I just don't believe that he will. I think that it's wrong for him to continue getting a third, fourth, fifth chance. I mean, when do you say that enough is enough? I don't think that it's appropriate, quite honestly, for him to keep getting another chance, but I also don't think it's right that he's not found guilty and convicted yet. He is, I really, truly believe that he is guilty.
What about the fact that Michelle had an affair with Brian Earley? You heard all about that. How did that have an impact on your thinking?
It really didn't. I felt that was just another tack mark against Cal, honestly. I believe that just made him more angry. I don't think that I don't think her boyfriend would have had any reason or any drive to do anything, any harm to her, where he, on the other hand, by her having a boyfriend and her tarnishing his name, he had a whole lot more to lose by her having a boyfriend than her boyfriend had about her having a future.
What about, you mentioned the witness that came forward. His name is Kevin Tubbs, a farmer. He came forward the day after your guilty verdict. What did you think about a witness coming forward the day after your guilty verdict?
I thought it was pretty coincidental, but I knew that at the very least it would get Cal another trial. And it made me have doubt. I'm certain it would have made a judge or a juror, you know, anyone. I would guess that other jurors with me would have felt the same way. Like, if he really had something of substance to say, it's possible we got it wrong. But I mean, like I said, I wasn't in the second jury. I don't know, you know, and I am a firm believer that unless you sat in that jury from the beginning to the end and heard every piece of testimony from every single person and were able to tie it all together, you really don't get to make a choice. You don't get to make a decision. There are too many small details that you could miss in one day that come back to play in 4 days later. And my trial was much shorter than this one, so tying them all together may have been even more difficult for the third jury.
Would you be surprised to learn or hear that Kevin Tubbs was paid off by Cal Harris? Paid some money for the testimony?
I would not.
Do you think then that Michelle Harris is dead rather than gone missing?
I do.
You've heard, of course, about Brian Earley, but did you know in the first trial that she actually had another boyfriend, that boyfriend may have caused Brian Earley to be upset?
I think in the first trial there was mention of both of her boyfriends, friends that I think she worked with him. Maybe he was maybe a cook in the back. I'm not sure at this point. But I did know that she may have had more than one boyfriend. I don't even know if you would call them all boyfriends, but she was seeing people. I believe that she was seeing people. I think she was trying to start a new life that was much different from the one that Cal provided for her, and I would not be surprised to hear that, no.
And that didn't make you more suspicious about Brian Earley?
It did not, because I would think that if that were the case, then Brian Early would have had confrontation with her other boyfriend, not with Michelle.
Very curious here. Was there any discussion in the deliberation room about how Cal Harris, one guy, could pull off this murder by himself in a fairly short time period, you know, from the evening to about 7 o'clock in the morning when the nanny comes there, and then get rid of her body? Was there any discussion about how Cal Harris could have pulled it off?
I think we did discuss it. We discussed it as a group just to try to get our arms around how that could have happened. We discussed the fact that his children could have still been in the room because they had noise machines, sleep machines that would have drowned out any noise. The dog wouldn't have been barking if it were someone who is part of the household, which would have fit for Cal. Timeline-wise, because there was so much time between the whole, Michelle didn't really need to be very far away for the first couple of days. I mean, and then he had an infinite amount of time between then and now. I mean, however many years had passed between when it actually September 11th and when our trial even was, we believed that he didn't really need to go very far, and he had so many opportunities and so many options and so much at his disposal. I mean, he had car after car after car in the lot and out of the lot, and he didn't really need to go very far in a short period of time. He had, you know, it's not as if he had no means of where or what could happen to her. I don't believe that it necessarily happened all at one time. I don't think necessarily. I don't know what happened to her. I don't try to speculate. It's not what he did with her afterward. I don't know. I don't really want to know, probably. But I do believe that he had more than enough means to put her in several places or to get rid of a certain amount of evidence at a time. And that was what added to my calculation. Like, I believe that he was calculating about it. I don't think it was something that happened on accident. I don't think it was something that, you know, I really think that it happened as his intent, and I think that he covered his tracks as well as he could, obviously, and had means to do that for a really long time.
It seems then like the jurors, the 12 people tasked with determining Cal's guilt, were sure that Cal murdered his wife. And yet this case is far from over. On June 8, 2007, the day after the guilty verdict, Kevin Tubbs enters the story. Now, according to Kevin, he saw a woman matching Michelle Harris's description arguing with a man who was not Cal, in the Harris driveway. The key to his revelation is that he says he saw her on September 12th, the day after Cal apparently murdered Michelle and hid her body. Based on this new information, on November 2nd, 2007, Cal Harris was set free on a $500,000 bail. So as of November 2007, Cal was a free man again. But will he stay that way? In the next episode, I'll discuss Kevin Tubbs. I'll also look at statements from his estranged wife that may make you question Kevin Tubbs' story. And down the road, I'm going to look at other theories on what could have happened to Michelle. As always, if you hear something or see something I don't, have questions or want some clarification, please just let me know. Use hashtag Wheel of Justice. Remember, that's WIEHL on Facebook and Twitter. Till next time.